Lawrence, if we do not give them the centre now, I think they will take it themselves, Temeraire said doubtfully.
Still, Wellesley did not give the order. The signal flags on the hill, when Temeraire could get a glimpse of them through the fog, showed still, hold fast.
I know, Lawrence said, we must keep off the advance as long as may be. If you will break their line at scattered points and engage the heavy weights...
Wait! Wait!
Persaetia cried shrilly from a distance, and Temeraire looked over, surprised, to see her flapping madly towards them. She looked very odd. All her artillery crew of militia were upon her back, tied on with ropes, and they in turn were helping to hold on her back enormous bundles of the carrying harnesses which had been used to bring the army hence. The harnesses had been made hastily of silk and linen, any which could be obtained, dresses and curtains and tablecloths all sacrificed to the cause, many in bright colours, so she looked as though she were wearing an enormous fringed skirt dangling over her sides and legs, just barely shy of fouling her wings.
"We are not going to retreat," Temeraire said indignantly. "We have not lost the battle, and we shan't either," he added determinedly.
"No, no,"
she said, panting as she came up to them, and Temeraire saw the harnesses were really so hopelessly tangled up that no one could have picked them apart in less than an hour.
"Take!"
she said, gulping for breath, and waggled some of it at him. Dubiously he took a bundle of it in his claws, and discovered it was wet, and it did not smell very nice either, like the smell when grog was passed out aboard a ship.
"What have you done with them?"
he said, and
"Ow!"
jerking his head back. There was something sharp and bitter which stung his nose.
"Liquor!"
Persaetia said, getting back her breath, as other dragons came and took more of the bundles from her.
"And also some tar, I think, and there is some pepper on them, too, so do not sniff them. Where is Iskierka? She must... Oh, there you are! No!"
she said, resisting as Iskierka reached for one herself.
"You shan't take one. You must set them all alight as we drop them."
"Oh, that is easy!"
Iskierka said. The angle wings each snatched a bundle, and the grey coppers, and a good many of the ferals, all the quicker dragons, the little ones.
"Hurry, hurry!"
Temeraire called. The French dragons were coming slow, but they were coming, and down below their infantry was already engaged in a dreadful struggle, bayonet to bayonet, which was spilling blood over the field and weakening the massed British squares. The French design plainly meant to leave them vulnerable to aerial attack. He led them all aloft, high aloft, and spreading out along in parallel to the French line, they let the bundles go. Iskierka shot after them eagerly, flames licking from her jaws in one burst after another, and the unravelling bundles caught with bright blue and yellow flames as they fell through the air. The French dragons recoiled from the fireballs dropping into their faces, fouling their smooth line.
"Now, at once!"
Lawrence said urgently, pointing at the weaknesses in their line.
"That chanson de guerre, and that défendeur brave!"
"Ballista, do you see?"
Temeraire called, and she waved her tail like a flag to show she had heard. A swarm of yellow reapers dashed after her as she charged the marbled yellow-brown chanson de guerre.
"Quickly, with me!" Temeraire said to the lightweights. "And do you want to come with us?"
he asked Persaetia.
"No, I do not,"
she said, hastily circling away.
"And anyway," she called back over her shoulder, "I will go see if I can make more of those bundles, although I think I have used all the spirits that were in the supply wagons."
Temeraire did not have time to listen to any more. They were hurrying down straight for the Défendeur, who had swerved to avoid a particularly large one of the fireballs that had left a thick trail of smoke behind. His flank was open now and unprotected for a moment by the line, and the grey copper Richter started in and opened a great slash along the line of his shoulder, nearly severing one strap of his harness. The Défendeur bellowed in pain and hunched himself towards the wound. A wide gaping slice, stark red against the golden brown and green of his hide.
"Ha!"
Richter called, and then squalled as the Défendeur snapped out his hook-ended tail and caught him full in the belly. A more dreadful and dangerous wound on so much smaller a beast, and Rictus was borne crying away by one of the angle wings. But he had opened an avenue for attack, and Velocitas flung himself to the Défendeur's rear, baiting the slashes of his tail and swerving this way and that, so the other angle wings and the grey coppers could make darting attempts on the Defendeur's head. And when the riflemen had all been flung off their feet, Minnow threw himself into the melee, landed upon the big dragon's back, and snatched away one of the men in her talons.
"There, that's your captain!" she called, waving the poor man,
and the French dragon roared furiously and went after her in a rush, bowling over one of the angle wings and breaking the French line completely, as Minnow raced away towards the British clearings with her prisoner.
"That is a little hard," Temeraire said,
feeling rather sorry for the poor dragon, and making a note Minnow should never again ride upon his own back while Lawrence was there. He had not thought she was quite so unscrupulous as to steal in the middle of a fight. But he could not deny it had been very handy at getting the big dragon away, and now he himself might clear away great swaths of middleweights just by roaring to either side of the gap the heavyweight had left. Requiescat was engaged with the Grand Chevalier in the next section of the line, and though he might have had a little edge in weight, her advantage in having a crew was telling against him. A steady rifle fire was peppering his massive sides, and had left a great many small holes visible in his wings, and she cleverly took every opportunity to position herself higher aloft, where he was forced to dodge one bomb after another which her bellmen flung against him. Temeraire saw that on their flank, too, the harnessed dragons of the corps were only just barely holding off the vast right wing of l'Armée de l'Air, also advancing, and they would soon all be forced into a tangled mess together.
"There are ships coming,"
Magistratus said, looping nearby.
"What?"
Temeraire said.
"Ships," Magistratus said laconically. "Out to sea. You can see them if you go over that cloud."
And then the trumpets were at last sounding the order to yield the centre with a shrill note, and there was no time to look. The squares below were falling back into column and marching away, and Temeraire had at once to be sure everyone was flying away properly to either flank as they were meant to do.
"Remember, we are to meet again behind their lines," he called urgently,
nipping an overexcited angle wing who had started to fly the wrong way. The French soldiers were charging forward more quickly now, and their dragons were stooping.
"Surely we ought not just fly away. They will have our men in a moment,"
Temeraire said urgently over his shoulder to Lawrence.
"Go!"
Lawrence said. He was looking through his glass at the sea.
"Go at once! You must get clear of the centre and aloft!"
Temeraire pulled away, and with a last anxious look over his shoulder. But as he did, he was startled to see the last of the Coldstream guards throwing themselves flat upon the ground, instead of marching away farther. And then a roar of thunder erupted from the fog-bank, smoke and orange flame. He broke over the top of the cloud-bank and saw them in that moment. 16 ships of the line, and the enormous gold-blazoned Victory at their head, with Nelson's Admiral's flag flying from the mast. All of them together were unleashing their full broadsides directly into the front rank of the French dragons and men, clouds of black smoke enveloping them even as the fog at last spilled off their sails and prows. The French dragons came down in shocking numbers. The heavyweights, one target after another, were struck with cannonballs, wings shattering and bones cracked. They came down into their own infantry below them. A few only managed with faltering beasts to carry themselves out over the remaining laggard lines of British infantry and smash them. The great Grand Chevalier crashed through the lines and dragged so far along the ground that she ended at last in the surf, shattered and still, her head rising and falling limply with the choppy waves as they crashed upon her shoulders. Temeraire felt a queer, confused shudder of sympathy, his wings wanting to come forward as if to protect his own breast. The trumpets were blowing again, and the British artillery on the flanks, whose force had all this while been blunted, opened a deadly hail of canister shot against the rear and flanks of the French infantry, chasing them forward into the endless rain of cannon fire from the ships.
"Temeraire!"
Lawrence called, and he started. Exidium was roaring out the signal distantly, and he was not yet in place. He flung himself hastily back. He no longer felt tired at all, the urgency of the moment trembling along his wings. He gathered up the others, who also had been distracted by the dreadful spectacle, all of them flying to join the dragons of the corps in a great single body, nearly 100 of them altogether, and as one they roared and charged the French reserves. The French soldiers were already reeling from so visible a disaster. The falling dragons could be seen for a good mile, and the wind was blowing harder now, clearing at last the clouds and fog. Nelson's flagship was plainly visible off the shore, the admiral's flag streaming out brilliant white and crossed with red, and the ships in line of battle ranged alongside Victory, the Minotaur, and the Prince of Wales, and all the rest of the fleet returned from Copenhagen, and some 6 prizes beside them, each pounding away now at the shore. The French broke at the attack from their rear and fled. But there was nowhere to run but into the waiting moor, a withering crossfire of navy and army guns at the ready to receive them. The British infantry marched at a steady trot into the emptied space, and Temeraire heard Lien at last. She was calling frantically as the infantry divided her and the last French aerial reserves from Napoleon and his guard. Napoleon had seen the trap, of course, and the retreat was sounding furiously from every French trumpet, but too late. The order of the French ranks had dissolved into one mass of terrified men, and the dragons, carried by their momentum, all came falling into the hail of cannon fire. Wellesley had committed all his reserves now, companies which had been held off to either flank, and emerging from the trees and fog with their artillery set up a wall of hot iron to prevent the French forces from retreating or regrouping. The tightening noose closed upon Bonaparte.
"Temeraire, the corps will help the infantry hold the line," Lawrence called. "We must keep off any who break through."
Temeraire could see Lien now clearly. She was yet on the ground, calling to direct the French dragons to try one thing after another, intent now only on breaking someone through, to rescue Napoleon and what other survivors could be rescued from the rack and ruin.
"Of course she would not come herself," Temeraire said contemptuously, as a great cloud of little dragons, she had even sent in the couriers, came racing forward. "Velocitas, you and all the other angle wings fall back to meet them, and you too, Monsi. Cantarella, when they have got them confused, you all harry them forward into the range of the ships."
The little dragons managed to dart through and past the heavy weights, but came quickly up against the pack of angle wings, too agile to easily be passed. Velocitas and the others slashed and snapped at the little dragons, chivying them along, breaking up the knot and dividing the dragons from one another, leaving them easy prey for the pouncing yellow reapers. Recoiling from so many larger dragons, they were herded into the crossfire.
"Temeraire, you must call Chalcedony back," Lawrence said sharply.
"Where?"
Temeraire said, looking round too late. Chalcedony had pursued one little Poux de Ciel too far, and with a dreadful hollow thump, one of the indiscriminate cannonballs took him directly in the chest. He seemed to fold up around the blow and fell without a sound. The little Poux de Ciel fluttered raggedly on, managed to thread the rain of iron, and broke out again into the open sky. It did not turn back for another attempt, but flew on across the channel towards France. A handful more had managed to get through, a few even had collected some handful of desperate soldiers from the ground and were straggling away over the water. But none had got near Napoleon himself, and the British infantry were advancing on his position. The guard had pulled into square around him, a mortal shield. Lien had seen the failure and his peril. She gave suddenly a loud shrilling call and took to the air herself.
"Oh!"
Temeraire cried eagerly. But she did not come. She turned instead away and fled over the fields with a scattered handful of French dragons behind her, her honour guard of British chevaliers, and a few half-blind fleurs de nuit with eye shades.
"Oh! Oh!"
Temeraire said, jouncing in the air with indignation.
"Oh, how cowardly! She is leaving him behind!"
"She will be going after the ships," Lawrence said. "Temeraire, quickly, turn so they can see you. Alan, the signal flags. Warning to ships, wing to northeast. Spell out for them, celestial. Nelson will understand."
"Shall we go and help them?"
Temeraire said, hopefully, hovering while Alan waved the flags urgently. It still looked to him as though Lien had run away, and he was sure if she did mean to try anything at the ships, it would just be an excuse. What she really wanted was to be out of the fighting, and he was sure she would flee for good as soon as she had made some small gesture.
If she does mean to run away, we ought to stop her. I was worried all along she should escape.
If we should engage, the British ships will not be able to fire upon her, Lawrence said. There, they have been warned. Do you see? He is directing some of their fire against her. Can you come about the other side? If she tries to flee towards France, we may then intercept her course.
It was a fine and elegant sight to watch the flank of the British line of battle wearing gracefully, one after another, to present their broadsides to the Dragon's coming around. Liane went nowhere near the ship's range, however. She had stopped, far distant, a small white figure against the grey sky, and now was hovering over the waves while the remnants of the French aerial forces wheeled and wheeled above her in tight circles. She was roaring. The echoes of the divine wind came carrying over the water even at such a distance, with a fine mist of wave spray steaming away from her in clouds of white.
"Have you any notion what she is doing?"
Lawrence asked. He was looking out at her through his glass.
"Perhaps she has gone mad over losing another companion," Temeraire offered.
He did not really think so, but he did not see what good it could possibly do her to be roaring at the water.
It is not as though water holds shape. Even if she breaks it, it will just come back together, so—"
He flicked his tail uncertainly.
"She is going nearer the ships, though," he added, "so they will be able to shoot her soon in any case."
Liane was indeed gradually approaching the ships, still roaring madly at the waves. She was so low now the waves were nearly lapping at her belly, rearing up to reach for her after every roar.
"Those waves are 10 foot above the rest of the swell," Lawrence said. "Mr. Allen, a signal for the ships. Storm anchors, not in our code, in the navies. Yes, the red and white, and then the green, and then the red circle. Temeraire, I do not know what she is about, but I think we cannot hazard letting her try it. Go after her, and quickly!"
Temeraire scarcely waited for the word and threw himself joyously forward. The waves did not seem so very high. They would not have reached over the sides of the tall ships, and he had been to sea enough to know they might manage much higher. But if they should be struck by so many waves, one after another, perhaps they could not fire their guns, and then Liane might come near enough to use the divine wind upon them. In any case, he privately cared only that he should at last have a chance at Liane, who had done nothing, only sat about watching while everyone else was hurt and killed. But even as he came, Liane abruptly stopped chasing the waves she had raised. Instead, she wheeled back from them some dozen wing beats. Temeraire was close enough, he could see the trembling of her breast and the way her wings wavered. She was very tired, and Temeraire pressed on with new urgency. He would have her now. She could not fly away quickly enough. Liane hovered a moment, drawing breaths, and then she charged after the waves once more. She swept low and level across the water, roaring so loud that the cannon still speaking behind Temeraire were drowned out. A fresh swell rose ahead of her in response, not so high as the others, but low and smooth, and moving very fast away. Spent by the effort, she fell silent and hung there in the air, trembling. Her head was almost limp, but the swell ran on without her to outpace and catch the elevated waves. As it met them, the waves seemed almost to stutter and collapse into it, one after another, melting into the hole. Temeraire heeled back, startled. With scarcely any warning, the wave had reared high enough to block Liane out, thrusting itself directly in his way, and his wingtip cut a line of spray in its face as he wheeled away just in time to keep from being caught by its rising crest. He thought, at first, he would just climb higher aloft and go over the wave, but he had no time. Behind him, the swell was rising, a dark, green, glossy wall of water so vast that now small curlers of foam were breaking upon its face as well as its crest, and he was racing it towards the ships.
"Temeraire!" Lawrence was crying out. "Temeraire, can you break it?"
Temeraire darted a look over his shoulder. The wave was still growing. He had never seen anything so vast, and a shudder trembled along the tip of his tail. They had weathered a typhoon once, in the Indian Ocean. A swirling wrath of clouds overhead, so he could not fly, and the Allegiance climbing and climbing each terrible rising wave, only to go rushing down the far side at shattering speed. But this was another thing entirely. almost not of the world in its monstrous size. But Lien had made it, she had raised it with the divine wind, and so surely he might break it. The wave came on after them, swift and dreadfully silent for all its great size, the choppy surface smoothing out before it as minor courtiers yielding way to a passing monarch. With frantic wing-beats he pulled away, trying to get a little more room to turn around. The ships were so very near now that he could read their names off their prows, and see men in the rigging, and darting about on the deck, little specks scurrying. Temrair was dripping with the spray, his wings streaming as he flew and flew. He could not gain elevation. He had not time to draw much breath, but he had gained all the ground there was to be gained, and he turned himself around and roared out with all his very might.
"Dear God, have mercy!" Lawrence said,
or thought he said, when he had wiped the salt from his eyes and looked back. Temeraire had broken them a hole in the wave, a great ragged patch standing open like a window for an instant, wherethrough they could still see a glimpse of the line, Victory with her pennants, all the line of battle, and their white sails gleaming like pearl against the thunderstorm colour of the ocean, and then doom was upon them. The great Neptune, broadside to the wave, fired her guns in a flaming golden roar before she was struck, a last shout of defiance, then she was gone. The ships, facing into the wave, rose up the shining face, their prows driving sea-foam pale gouges into the monster, mere pinpricks, climbing bravely, until one after another they were overturned in cataracts of white foam and swallowed into the green mass. The wave slouched onward down the channel, subsiding gradually as it ran, the shoulders of a giant irritated, shrugging away. One solitary ship of the line, the Superb, bobbed at anchor, all her masts snapped away and water pouring from her sides. Two frigates, which had dropped their anchors in time, were on their beam ends, and struggling to right themselves before they too sank. A few human specks in the water were clinging to wreckage. Of 14 ships of the line, nothing else remained, like castles built in sand, swept away by the tide. No cannon spoke, nor guns. Even the personal knots of fighting stilled. In the silence now the last of the French dragons came flying, massed in a desperate arrowhead lunge into the sudden gap in the crossfire, and the guard ran forward, packed around Napoleon to meet them.
"Temeraire!"
Lawrence called. A frantic trumpet signal was blowing the alarm. Temeraire struggled wearily to turn, calling out to the other dragons. Already a small, lithe chasseur vociferé was leaping away from the ground, and Napoleon was on her back. Temeraire made for the party, but four of the French dragons wheeled to meet them, smaller pêcheurs rayés, but valiant, clawing and shrieking, heedless of how they themselves were cut about. Ballista dived into the fray, lashing a couple of them across the heads with her tail, and Requiescat was charging in to join them, roaring in fury, but the chasseur was away, fleeing across the channel, and after her went five others, burdened with dozens of guardsmen, a cloud of musketry trailing. They were clear. Across the water, Lien, crumpled, was being supported away over the channel by her escort, a couple of petit chevaliers, labouring mightily to keep her in the air. The last of the French dragons broke away and fled. The men yet on the field threw down their guns and sank most of them to their knees, or to all fours, broken with exhaustion. 19 eagle standards lay trampled and mired in the blood-churned mud, amid 20,000 corpses. The day was won. Chapter 16.
"Lawrence, I will do you credit. I have never in my life met any man more desirable to hang, and less convenient," Wellesley said. "Oh, and after everything we have done," Temeraire said indignantly. "No more than you ought, and less than some," Wellesley fired back. "It is a damned pity you could not get yourself decently killed on the field. Better than you managed it."
Lawrence put his hand on Temeraire's forearm to restrain.
"Yes, sir. And the same could be said of many another."
Wellesley, or rather Wellington now, he had taken the new name with the ducal coronet that was his reward, snorted. They sat on the portico of Temeraire's own pavilion, his first opportunity to take up residence, though Lawrence had built it for him months before. Their journey to Africa and imprisonment had intervened, and in the interim it had become a general residence. Even now a few other dragons napped in corners, and nearby Persaetia was very audible lecturing her former militia. She had brought the men along with her after the battle, those who would be bribed by a share of her treasure, in their mixing of mortar. They were putting up another pavilion. A tremendous crash heralded the arrival of another load of bricks. Requiescat, assisting with the construction and fired with enthusiasm, had carried alone what looked to be nearly 5 tons. Wellington looked broodingly at the heap and the foundations for the next pavilion over, which were busily being excavated by Minnow and half a dozen of her fellows. Dirt flew at a prodigious rate.
"Where are you getting that brick?"
"We have bought it," Persaetia said, overhearing this question. "So you needn't try and complain. We are stealing. We have sold our eagles and have capital."
"And God help us all," Wellington said, tapping his fingers against his thigh. "You ought to be made to pay damages out of it. Do you know I had nearly a mutiny on my hands the next day? Not one drop of beer or rum to be had among 100,000 men, and a good 10,000 casualties."
"If you did not like it," Persaetia said, "you ought to have managed the battle more neatly, and then I shouldn't have needed to find a way to stop those French dragons for so long." This was not a little outrageous, considering that Wellington had managed to stage a battle of 200,000 men, 300 dragons, and 2 dozen ships of the line nearly to his exact specifications, and to hold worse ground against an army better trained and better equipped than his own for nearly 3 hours longer than planned, until the fog had loosened its grip enough for the ships to make their way in close enough to shore to begin the bombardment.
"Damn your impudence," he growled.
But Persaetia only flipped her wings at him a little and loftily went back to her pavilion. It was mid-morning, the 17th of March. Some 2 weeks had passed since the battle and its immediate aftermath. Lassitude and dull confusion over so great a triumph and disaster mingled. The survivors had man and beast sunk to the ground and slept where they stood, uneasily, listening to the chorus of the low sighs of the dying yet upon the field, men starting up with cries whenever a greater wave came crashing upon the rocky shore. The next day, without direction, they had begun the immense effort of clearing away the dead. Temeraire and his cohort had attended to the dragons. Not all were dead. Many lingered, broken and slowly bleeding out their lives, dull-eyed and surrounded by the shattered bodies of their crew. Some were coaxed with much nudging and support back onto their feet, to limp away over the ground to the surgeon's clearing. Others, worse injured, could only be given a merciful end. Some of the aviators also had survived, shielded from the worst of the impact by their dragon's body, and had to be taken away to join the other prisoners. Chalcedony's body lay stretched upon a green hill, a slash of white and yellow. Whole, it seemed, until they turned him over and saw the shattered red ruin of his chest. The yellow reapers nudged their shoulders beneath him, and in a knot carefully lifted him up to carry off the field.
"But where will we take him?" Gladius said, much subdued.
"We will take him to the old quarantine grounds," Temeraire said, "near Dover, where the sick dragons were buried."
They had laid Chalcedony and their other dead to rest in another of the great barrow mounds rising in the valley of the quarantine. Early green shoots were climbing valiantly out from the softening cover of snow, and the earth smelt richly moist as the dragons turned it over to raise the mound. More from habit than any conscious thought, they had flown on to Dover looking for food. But habit served well enough. Many dragons of the corps had returned also to their own clearings, and the ground crews and herdsmen were bringing in what cattle could be rounded up and shared out. A week later, a groundskeeper from the old Wales breeding ground, a fellow named Lloyd, appeared at Temeraire's pavilion, bedraggled but plodding on, too stubbornly fixed in his course to alter it, with the beginning of a string of cattle.
"Why, Lloyd," Temeraire said, "where have you got these cows from?"
He did not wait for an answer to begin eating.
"The pens in London," Lloyd said,
accepting with gratitude a cup of tea, though he looked around first for spirits.
"Well, and they were ours first, weren't they?" he added, with a self-righteous air.
So perhaps their provenance was best not inquired after very far. The dragons from Dover came every so often and looked wistfully at the work going forward.
"I do not see why we cannot have one at the covert, too," Maximus said, rumbling in dissatisfaction. "Iskierka does. Do I have a few thousand pounds to spare on erecting you a temple?" Berkeley said. "Nonsense! All this complaining! You have slept outside all your life and never taken an ounce of harm from it!"
But shortly a collection had quietly been taken up among the officers, and a friendly rivalry began among the dragons to see whose should be completed first. Through such visitors Lawrence had some word from London, what news anyone could scarcely avoid hearing. The king retired to Kensington, and the Prince of Wales made regent for him. Bonaparte successfully escaped to Paris, though with his tail between his legs. The newspapers were full of patriotic fervour and mourning for Nelson and the lost seamen, spoken of as martyrs for their nation. All the while, no one had sought to prevent their coming and going, nor paid them any official notice, but Lawrence had known the situation an ephemeral one. The wheels of government might yet be some time restoring their course after so great a disruption, but inevitably they would fall into the cart tracks. Treason could not be simply ignored. Wellington's arrival had surprised him only that it was Wellington and not Jane sent to demand his surrender, or some lesser officer. But it did not encourage him.
"Sir," Lawrence said, "I trust you have sufficient demands upon your time. You did not come for the purpose of inquiring after our work. If you want something of me, I hope you will speak freely."
"But Lawrence is not going to prison, or to be hanged," Temeraire put in, "and if that is what you came for, you may go away again. Come with an army and take him, and try if you can."
"We are not going to start a pitched battle against you and your pack of rogues, if that is what you mean,"
Wellington said.
"I know damned well about your little pact, that Longwing and that regal copper who are going about Dover telling everyone that if we should come against you they will fight with you, and so should every other dragon or their captains will be taken away next."
Lawrence looked at Temeraire, who had the grace to look abashed, but not very, and retorted,
"You haven't any right to complain if I do not trust you. You have tried to take Lawrence before, and now where is our pay that we ought to have received, and the coverts which you promised to open to us?"
"That is enough,"
Wellington said.
"You had my word, and my word is good. You will have your coverts and your pay, and no later than any other scoundrel who stood up under fire. It will be half a year before the government can pay off all its arrears, and you will have to lump it until then. You are not starving, at least, which is more than many an Englishman can say."
"Well, then," Temeraire said, a little mollified, "I am sorry if I was rude. If you will keep your promises, and you do not mean to try and put Lawrence in prison, then what do you want, after all?"
"What I want," Wellington said, "or rather what His Majesty's government wants, is to be shot of you. Submit to the King's justice, and your sentence will be commuted, to transportation and labour."
Temeraire snorted at justice, and with much suspicion had to have the sentence explained to him that the government meant Lawrence should be sent abroad to the colony of New South Wales.
"But that is on the other side of the world. That is as bad as putting you in prison again," Temeraire protested. "I will certainly not let them send you so far away from me."
"No,"
Lawrence said, watching Wellington's face.
"That, I imagine, is not the intention. Sir, it cannot be wise to send Temeraire away, not when the French yet have Lien. Whatever you may think of me, it is too high a price."
"You are a little dull today, Lawrence," Wellington said. "The price is giving you your life, and their lordships think it cheap as a way to be rid of a dragon who, if he takes it into his head, can sink half the shipping in Dover Harbour."
Temeraire flared out his wrath.
"That is very rude," he said. "I would never do anything so cruel to the fishermen and the merchants. Why ever would I?"
The story of Lien's feat had crossed the country entire at wildfire speed, carried across the country with news of victory and Nelson's death by the victorious soldiers marching back to London and their homes. It had not gained much in the telling. There was not much to gain, either in horror or in amazement. But Lawrence was dismayed to find the fear which it had whipped up thus transferred to such irrational action, and said so.
"If this is a dreadful weapon, the French possess it also. Merely to ignore it ourselves does no good, any more than you would melt down your own cannon because the French had fired one upon you. When they have built a cannon which chooses now and again to turn around and fire into their faces instead, and means to persuade all their other cannon to do the same, I will gladly leave it to them," Wellington said. "No, Lawrence, you see before you a convert. You have entirely convinced me that the beasts are sapient, and now I am damned if I will let you make them political. We can better support a defence against one solitary beast than your Whiggish rabble-rousing among 10,000 of them." "But if you agree we are intelligent, not that it is not perfectly obvious, then you cannot deny we have every right to be political," Temeraire said. "I can and will deny you or any man or beast the right to tear apart the foundations of the state," Wellington said. "Rights be damned! We will never hear an end of anyone crying for their rights."
When he had gone, Temeraire looked sidelong at Lawrence.
"I am sure no one can make us go, if we do not like," he said, "and I do not care what Wellesley thinks, or Wellington, even if he is a duke now."
Lawrence put a hand on Temeraire's foreleg and looked out over the valley. It was a view improved over the last summer, with the verdant growth coming up over the undulating hills of the Barrow Mounds, and the sheep and cattle Lloyd had gathered dotting the green hills as they browsed. It was all England and home laid out before him, creeping out from under the shadow. And now he must leave it forever for a distant, dry country.
"We must go," he said.
"I am sending a few eggs on your transport," Jane said. "They need some beasts in New South Wales to forward the settlement."
She sat down upon the edge of a boulder. They had walked a little way from the pavilion to have some privacy, and up a hillside where they might have a view all the way to the sea, grey mist hanging over the water, and at its edges a little glitter of sunlight, a few white sails.
"Can they be spared?"
Lawrence asked.
"More easily than they can be kept," Jane said. "Before you brought us your cure, we thought we should have to replace the entire population of the isles. Now there are more eggs keeping warm than we will be able to feed in a year, after all this plundering and bad management. As for our friend across the way," she added, tossing a pebble over the side of the cliff, vaguely in the direction of France, "Bonaparte lost 40 beasts in his adventures here. He will not come over again shortly, and we will be ready for him if he does."
He nodded and sat down beside her. Jane absently rubbed her hands together and blew upon them. There was still a chill in the air. Below, Exidium was inspecting the foundations with interest, Poseitia cajoling him to spray a channel for her in some of the stones with his acid, so it should allow water to run off more easily.
"I am afraid, Lawrence, you will officially be a prisoner. It is understood you shan't be put in irons, or anything which should distress Temeraire, but so far as formality..."
"I could expect nothing else,"
she sighed.
"At any rate, I have had some work to persuade their lordships to do anything but the ungracious, and there will be crews for the new hatchlings going along, of course, so I have managed that you will have your handful also among them."
"You will not send Emily, surely?" Lawrence said.
"I would not send anyone else if I was not ready to send her," Jane said. "No, she is a sturdy creature, and any road I would rather risk her health than her spirit. She will do better to be as far away from my station as she can. I suppose you have not heard yet. They have named me Admiral of the Air."
And she laughed.
Wellington, I must say now, is a damned hard-headed bastard. But, do you know, he insisted on it, and that they create me a peer or some such nonsense, only they're still arguing over how to manage it without they let me sit in the Lords."
"I congratulate you most heartily," Lawrence said, and shook her hand. "But, Jane, we will be halfway across the world. I do not even know what we will do there."
"They will find out some work for you, I have no doubt," Jane said. "They mean to find a way into the interior. Dragons will make easy work of that, and if nothing else, you may help them clear land. It is a waste, of course," she added, "and I hope we do not have cause to regret it. But I will tell you honestly, Lawrence, I am glad you will go. I have not liked to think what should happen if you did not."
"I would not raise civil war," he said.
"You would not.
I'm not so sanguine about him," Jane said, looking down at Temeraire, presently settling some sort of squabble arisen between Cantarella and Poseitia. Of course, half the Yellow Reapers had divided into the quarrel on Cantarella's side at once. "But as for Emily, I do not mean to give anyone opportunity to whisper of special treatment, or try to work on me through her, either for good or ill. With 3 or 4 beasts established, there will be enough scope for her to advance a while, and ships come and go often enough. I'm only worried for Catherine." Riley and the Allegiance would be their transport, as so often before, and Catherine, of course, could not be spared, even if she had wished to go. "Only I do not know whatever to do about the boy," Catherine said. "I do not quite like to let him go." "I do not see why," Lily muttered, not very quietly. "But if he is to go to sea, I suppose he had better begin as he will go on. And if he should prefer the corps some day, there will be dragons enough, and perhaps he ought to be with his father." Catherine finished at dinner that evening. She and Berkeley had come out to see him off, as of course Lawrence could not come to the covert to dine while legally a prisoner. They sat together in the pavilion around a small, convenient card table, eating roast mutton and bread, sheltered from the wind by the dragons dozing comfortably around them. Lawrence, with some reluctance, said,
"Harcourt, under ordinary circumstances I would not presume to offer advice on such a point, but you must recall, she will be a prison ship for the journey. She will be carrying prisoners."
The ordinary transports ran twice a year. The Allegiance would go out of turn, but she was so vast that a great many convicts could be crammed into her between decks.
"I suppose they will not be let to wander the ship," she said, surprised.
And he had to convey some sense of the natural order of a prison ship, the dreadful frequency of scurvy and fever and dysentery, the misery and regular danger of rebellion. He was sorry to find his descriptions borne out when they came to the Allegiance the next morning at Sheerness Dockyard. It was not pleasant to see their familiar and faithful transport all at loose ends, her crew a sad and surly crowd of pressed landsmen, some of them not far removed from the poor wretches who could be heard and smelled down beneath, clanking restlessly in the irons which must restrain them so close to shore. Nearly every able seaman had been plundered away by ships with nobler duties, and captains with more influence than Riley, having perhaps been tainted by too much association with Lawrence, could muster to keep them for such a mission. A grating was already rigged, and fresh bloodstains beneath showed it had lately seen use. The boatswain and his mates were bodily shoving the men to their work. Across the harbour another vessel was making ready to go down the Thames, on the same wind which would keep the Allegiance in port a while longer. She made a stark contrast, a sailing barge flat-bottomed and small next to the behemoth of a dragon transport, and manned to precision by a tiny handful of sailors all in black. Even her sails were dyed black, and her sides had been freshly painted, so there was no waterline to mar her side. A great casket, black and gold painted, was gently and respectfully being conveyed onto her, while her officers stood at attention.
"That is Nelson's coffin," Lawrence said, when Temeraire quietly inquired.
A hush had fallen over all the ship, and even the most bitter of the impressed landsmen had been silenced by the fists of their fellows, if not by a sense of decorum, while the casket was in view. Tears showed on hardened faces, and Lawrence could hear one man sobbing like a child somewhere up in the rigging. A confused prickling of tears stood in his own eyes. Nelson had given Britain mastery of the sea at Trafalgar. From Copenhagen he had brought back 18 prizes and secured the passages of the Baltic Sea. All the month before the battle at Shoeburyness had been joined, he had with his fleet swept the channel clean of French shipping and beaten away at the regular French flights, so Napoleon should have no reinforcements. The ships had concealed their flags and painted over their names, so no one should realize he had returned, and for love of him not a man out of 5,000 sailors and more had deserted, even while the ships hid in home ports. His personal sins might have been excused, though Nelson had selfishly exposed his wife to the misery of his flagrant unfaithfulness, and his friend Lord Hamilton to the astonished censure of the world. If Lady Hamilton had rescued her reputation by her heroic spy work in the occupation, it did not redeem Nelson's choice. But if, for so much victory and sacrifice, all these venial matters should have been passed over. There were worse evils to Nelson's account. He had defended slavery, and without a qualm advocated the hideous murder of those thousands of dragons, allies and neutrals, as well as their enemies, by the spreading of the plague, evils Lawrence could never forgive, at whose consequence he would personally bear the rest of his life. Yet for a moment Lawrence could feel nothing but the deepest, wrenching misery, watching the barge heave off the dock and those black sails filling, a grief unburdened by judgment, a grief he might have felt wholeheartedly in another life. Guns were firing as the barge passed away down the river, an impromptu thunder of salutes. A hurried struggle went forward on the deck behind him, and the Allegiance's ragged crew managed by simple weight of her massive 32s to contribute a meaningful roar or two to the procession, though they could not yet fire a broadside in unison. The barge vanished swiftly over the horizon, carried inland by wind and tide. Distantly the salutes went on like a receding storm, and at last faded entirely. The Allegiance groaned softly at her anchors, and the unhappy life of the ship resumed behind him. Lawrence breathed again. He had not wept in the end. Temeraire had watched the procession with interest. Now he stretched his wings, cautiously to keep them in line with the wind and not abreast of it, and asked, "Will we leave soon?"
"When the captain and the passengers are come aboard," Lawrence said. "In a few days, perhaps, if the wind turns fair."
They, of course, had been required aboard earlier, as they were not passengers but prisoners. And if Lawrence were disposed to forget their official status, the first lieutenant, Lord Purbeck, was not. A guard, a wholly useless guard, two marines armed with muskets, whom Temeraire might accidentally have knocked over without noticing, had been placed on the steps to the dragon deck, and when Lawrence looked for his things they had been stowed in a small, dark cabin beside the stern ladderway, two decks down. As near to the jail deck as practical without being right in it, and full of the stench. To this he was followed by the guard, and they looked as though they would have liked to keep him in it, until he said,
"You may go up, then, and explain to Temeraire. I am not allowed to come to him."
The aviators began to come aboard irregularly. They were not an assembled crew, of course, with their own dragon, but rather were drifting over from Dover Covert by twos and threes, including two of the captains Jane had sent. Both of them older men lately dropped to earth by the death of their former dragons, in the dreadful epidemic, long before anyone had looked for such an event. Experienced men who might have looked for long careers ahead of them. Another man they would take aboard in Gibraltar. Three eggs were to be sent with them. These were delivered with great care and attention by a party of three dragons. The eggs, swaddled in cotton wadding and lowered down into a nest built for them over the galley, were not what anyone would call a real prize. One yellow reaper, and one unfortunate cross between a checkered nettle and a Parnassian, who had somehow produced a shockingly small egg that looked more likely to produce a Winchester than a heavyweight. The third, delivered by Arcady himself, was his own, or so he smugly informed them, and had been lately produced by Ringe. He was not at all sorry to see the egg go, convinced it was an especial honour to have it sent to a wide-open and unclaimed territory, although he stayed a long time lecturing Temeraire sternly on his duty of oversight and care, and extracting promises Temeraire should be sure the egg was not touched by anyone at all, and that only someone very rich should be permitted to become the captain.
"I'm glad to see you again before we go," Lawrence said to Tharkay awkwardly.
They had not spoken since that day in the camp, when Tharkay had so easily and so wrenchingly cut him to the bone. Lawrence scarcely knew whether to apologize or to express gratitude.
"You need not bid me farewell just yet." "I am coming," Tharkay said. "Captain Riley has been good enough to invite me as his guest." "I did not know you knew him," Lawrence said, as near as he could come to questioning. "I did not," Tharkay said. "But Captain Harcourt was good enough to introduce me. I am tolerably well in pocket at present, thanks to your admiral's generosity," he added, seeing that Lawrence was surprised. "And I have never been to Terra Australis. The journey tempts me."
Wanderlust might drive a man across the ocean or to the farther side of the world. It would not drive him aboard a ship with one he despised, when funds would have allowed him to choose his passage.
"Then I am glad we shall be shipmates," Lawrence said, as far as he could trust himself to express his feelings without giving mortification to himself or any other.
Riley came aboard late, and grim, and alone, with the tide already making a noise against her sides. He did not come to greet Lawrence, of course, but neither did he say anything to the two captains, or to Tharke, technically at least his guest. He went instead directly to his cabin, and came out only to weigh anchor and make sail before sequestering himself again. Purbeck knew his work, and managed, despite the very awkward crew, to get them out of the harbour with only the least direction, and then the black waters of the channel were slipping away behind them. Temeraire put his head over the side and studied the waves as they went, and said to Lawrence, "I only wish I knew how she did it. I might practice to work it out." But Lawrence, with some energy, dissuaded him, although Temeraire protested he would only make the waves go away from the ship. Even so, Lawrence did not think Riley or the sailors would like it. Temeraire sighed and settled himself again. It was bad enough to be facing so long a sea journey again, when all his friends were building pavilions, and soon to have pay. It was worse yet to be sent to such a strange and unfriendly country which had no dragons at all. He was sure if it were at all nice, some dragons would have gone there before, so it must be wholly dreadful. And he was particularly anxious for the eggs. Not that he would let anything happen to them, of course, but it was a heavy responsibility, and none of them even his own. It did not seem very fair.
"Will it be very long?"
he asked Lawrence the next morning, already feeling rather discouraged by the monotony of the horizon. He was gloomily unsurprised to hear they should be sailing for 7 months or longer.
"We must put in at Gibraltar, and then at St. Helena," Lawrence said, "as we cannot put in at the Cape any more, and then likely again at New Amsterdam."
"And you are sure we might not just as well go to China?" Temeraire asked. "We might fly there overland."
But Lawrence did not wish to do it.
"I do not mean to be a martyr," he said, "but the law must be the law for everyone, and it has bent for me a great deal already, and for you, however grudgingly. Though our actions were just, I cannot easily forget that others, who had a claim on our loyalty and our service, have suffered by them, and that our enemies thereby have profited. We have left behind England safer than she was, and free, thank God. I need not reproach myself for that. But I would yet gladly do what honourable work I might find in her service to repay the debt I owe, even if I may only do it indirect."
Temeraire would have objected strongly if anyone else had suggested that Lawrence owed any more than he had given. But he could not very well quarrel with Lawrence himself on the subject, if he had liked to, when he owed Lawrence a debt too. Only he wished they were not going so very far. Already the days had begun to drag intolerably.
"Wing, 2 points off the larboard stern!"
the lookout cried, and Temeraire roused hopefully. Perhaps it would be a battle, or perhaps Volley coming to call them back to England, or Maximus and Lily come to bear him company, so they should all go together.
"But it is none of them. It is Iskierka,"
he said disgruntledly. When she had come close enough, he could see the thin cloud of steam trailing her. She was flying a little sluggishly and tired, and she thumped down upon the dragon deck in much disarray. She did not have even her full harness on, and none of her crew, only Granby latched on to her neck strap.
"What are you doing here?"
Temeraire demanded, while she thirstily drank up 2 barrels of his water. She settled herself more comfortably, looping her massive coils in a very inconvenient way, half sprawling over the deck, and some of them dangling over the sides, so that Temeraire could not help but notice that in reaching her full length she had grown longer than he was himself.
"I am coming with you."
"No, you are not," Temeraire said. "We are transported. You are not. You had better go back at once."
"Well, I cannot," she said. "I'm too tired to fly back now, and by tomorrow morning it will be too far, so we may as well go on."
"I do not see what you want to come for anyway," Temeraire said.
"I told you that you might give me an egg when we had won," Iskierka said, "so I have come to keep my promise."
"But I do not want to give you an egg at all," Temeraire said. "I do not want you aboard the ship either. You take too much room, and you are damp."
"I do not take any more room than you, at least not much more,"
Iskierka said, to add insult to injury.
"And I am warmer, so you needn't quarrel."
"And," Temeraire said. "You are disobeying orders again. I'm sure of it. Granby would never let you come."
"Oh, well," she said, "one cannot always be obeying orders. When will we be there?"
"It is this dratted egg," Granby said to Lawrence. "She is set on it, having fire, and the divine wind. I have tried and tried to tell her it won't work so, but she will not listen. And now here we are."
"You may take her off at Gibraltar," Lawrence suggested.
"Oh, yes, if she will choose to go,"
Granby said, and sat down upon an emptied cask of water, limp with defeat. Iskierka, having been given a pig to eat, had already in satisfied complacence gone to sleep. Her steadily issuing cloud of vapour went spilling over the bow and trailing away along either side of the ship, as though to illustrate their steady pace farther away from England. Temeraire had pushed her mostly to one half the dragon deck as best he could, and now sat coiled up and disgruntled, with his ruff flattened against his neck.
"You may be glad of the company before we have crossed the line," Lawrence said, by way of comfort.
"I will not, even if I am very bored, any more than I would be glad of a typhoon,"
Temeraire said broodingly, "and I am sure she will be a bad influence upon the eggs."
Lawrence looked at Iskierka and at Granby, who was presently drowning his sorrow in a glass of rum. Tharke had come on deck and prudently caught one of the runners to send for a bottle.
"At least you need not fear for their safety," he suggested.
"Unless she should set the ship on fire," Temeraire said,
a good deal too loudly for the comfort of any sailor in earshot, which might have omitted those two decks below, or in the stern.
"Then I am afraid you must study philosophy," Lawrence said, "and learn to bear the misfortune. I hope the arrangement is at least preferable to the breeding grounds."
"Oh, anything might be better than that, and still be dreadful," Temeraire said,
and with a sigh settled his head down forward.
"Pray, Lawrence, let us have the Principia Mathematica, as there is nothing better."
"Again,"
Lawrence said, but sent Emily down for the book. She returned, scowling at the state of his quarters, but with a shake of his head he dissuaded her from any word to Temeraire.
"Where shall I begin?"
he asked. But he did not immediately hear the answer as he looked down and put his hands on the book. His fingers caught on the delicate pages and traced the embossed lines of the heavy cover, leather stamped with gilt. The same book under his hands, the salt wind in his face, Temeraire at his side. Nothing changed outwardly, and yet in his essentials he felt as wholly altered as if he had been reborn since the last time he had set foot upon the deck of a ship, a tide coming in high and fast, which had swept clean the sand.
"Lawrence," Temeraire said, "would you prefer another?"
"No, my dear," Lawrence said. "I do very well."
This is Simon Vance. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Victory of Eagles by Naomi Novik. Executive producers Kelly Gilday and Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2008 by Naomi Novik. Production copyright 2008, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.